Hello and welcome to episode 75 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is Janae Libby. Want to shout out to a couple of sponsors. Thank you to Teej.fm, T-E-E-J.fm. It's a collaborative podcast community brought to you by WTJU. Thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of your community. And to my sponsors at Patreon, patreon.com/audaciouspod. Patreon is a wonderful service that allows artists and creators to keep on doing what they do best. Thank you to Patreon. Big fat episode today, guys. I'm a little throaty and froggy. We'll get through it. Welcome to episode 75. Hello and welcome to Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons, where food is often just the starting point for many deeper conversations on life, love, and why are we even here? Thank you for being my guest today. I am Janae Libby, your podcast host, and I'm a food writer, although I do write about other things. Wow, I'm a little froggy today. I've been doing a lot of talking the past 2 weeks. A lot of talking in the past 3 days, actually. I'm recording this on Thursday. I think it's Thursday. I have to admit, my mind feels like somebody took it and stuck it in a salad spinner and went push, 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 and just let it go. I'm a little frazzled. And as a result, my mind might be a little scattered today, but we're doing it. We're going to get through it. Why do I do this? Why do I put myself through this? For community, to talk with rather than about people online, food folks in particular. I focus on food work and the folks who labor in our kitchens, field stores, and boardrooms, people who are audacious about what they do. I'm so glad you've joined me here today for my conversation with Clay and Linda Trainum of Autumn Olive Farms. This was a 360 experience. I got to tour the farm. I got to ride out on the ATV to hear the piggies. Gonna provide you with some audio with that here in the podcast, in the conversation. So you'll be looking forward to that. They were quite chatty. It's funny, one breed was chattier than the other. The British breed had a lot to say. The ones that come from South Carolina were a bit quiet when I rode up and held my recorder up to their snouts. They did not like it, but the English breed had a lot to say. You'll hear that here very soon. You can find me on iTunes. My website is audacious.co. Why am I in a salad spinner? Why am I so froggy? Boy, there's been a lot going on, guys. Good grief. A lot in the world. I'm so busy, I can't even pay attention to what's going on in the world. There was about a 5-day period in the past 2 weeks where I did not even get on social media. I'm very behind. Bad marketer. Mr. John Copper of Flourish Digital would be fussing at me right now. He was one of our speakers at the Community Investment Collaborative course that I just finished, a 16-week course for how to run a business, how to start a business. We had our graduation on Tuesday. I want to give a shout out to all of my fellow colleagues, all of my classmates in the CIC program. Congratulations, guys. We made it through. Congratulations. Now, sashay away and go make history. Start that business or make the business you have that much more successful. Najib Shuaf of Flora Cheese is a former CIC alum. He took the course, he graduated, and last week he placed third in the world in an international cheesemonger competition in Paris. I will not attempt the name. I'll have the link in the show notes. Congratulations, Najib. An American has never placed in this competition, only Europeans. This is a major, major milestone. And shortly thereafter, Najib announced that Flora would be closing. He has great things on the horizon. I had him on this podcast about a year and a half ago. I'll be reposting that episode so you can go listen to it, or you can just go to the website and search it out. It was a great conversation about cheese. I knew when I talked to him that he was destined for great things. He's a wonderful person and so talented. At Flora, I just said, give me three cheeses. I don't even care which ones you pick because all of them are always stellar. So congratulations to Najib. I also want to send best wishes to Caleb Warr, the chef at Tavola, who recently left us for Cape Cod, Massachusetts. I met Caleb at a volunteer event at Montalto for an Alice Waters dinner. We were kitchen help that day. It was a very cute way to meet. We were the first ones who arrived. We were so excited. We got to have this major cooking experience. He's way more talented than me. They put him to work breaking down goats for the dinner while I was left washing herbs because I'm not a chef. But he's a wonderful chef. I've had so many great dinners at Tavola from Caleb, and we wish him well. And please don't be a stranger, Najib and Caleb. Remember the little folk when you get famous and come visit us every so often. Boy, what else? What else has been happening on the list? Oh my God, in 2 weeks. Good grief. Good grief. I'll try and get through it. Just yesterday, I had three meetings in one day. I don't tend to do that because my brain turns to mush. It turns into a salad. But I had an emergency last week, so I had to push all of my interviews and all of my talks and meetings to yesterday. But it turned out to be such an amazing, amazing thing. My first meeting was with Brian Weimer. He is the organizer of Love Fest, a two-day festival at Ix Park. It's $25 for one day, $40 for a weekend pass. I will be there this weekend recording, walking around, talking about people or talking to people about love. Big love, small love, all kinds of love. It's the Love Fest. It's the 50th celebration for the Summer of Love. I was almost born in the Summer of Love, born in the Spring of Love in 67, so this is a festival very near and dear to my heart. There will be music, there will be tons and tons of food trucks, all your favorite Charlottesville food trucks will be there. Noon to midnight one day and noon to 11 the next day, 21 hours total of love and food and concerts and me. You can come shake my hand, talk into the mic, become a star, get famous, and be on the podcast. So come see us at Love Fest. I met with him yesterday. We talked about how Audacious could be a part of this community initiative, this community festival that brings food and people together, all people, all food, all kinds of different music. Something very near and dear to my heart, as you know, if you have listened to even one episode of Audacious. So thank you, Brian, for meeting with me, and I hope we can create some great things together. I also met with a student, a new graduate who is interested in being a food writer. I met her at the Big Love Bake Sale, my first fundraiser here at Audacious that we had about a month and a half ago. She is very interested in food writing, wanted to talk to me about how she could get started, and it made me so thrilled and so excited, and it validated me because I thought, this is why I'm doing this. I wasn't sure that anyone was interested in the food writing episodes, and the fact that even one person contacted me and wanted to talk more about it, that's enough. That's enough for me to keep doing what I'm doing, even when I'm froggy and talking throaty and sounding a little bit like Demi Moore, but maybe some of you like that. So maybe that helps. Who knows? And speaking of the Big Love Bake Sale, wow. Any of you who have cancer in your life, whether you have it, I'm so sorry, whether a family member has it, a friend, maybe it's peripheral, maybe you have a friend of a friend who has it, you know that cancer is a long journey. It's not a one-hour episodic television show where the person is cured at the end of 60 minutes. It's often very long, very involved, and full of triumphs and tragedies, extreme highs and lows. Almost every experience you have with that person, you're not sure whether it's the last one. If it's happy, you want to record it, you want to remember it, you want to be in it and have that awareness and go, yeah, I'm in this right now. This is happening and I'm so happy to be with this person. I've had a few of those experiences in the past 2 weeks. As you guys know, my best friend has cancer, Scotty Nichols. Nobody ever calls him Scott or Scotty. They always say Scotty Nichols. He hates it. It's like me with Janae. It took me a long time to love and like my name, even like my name. But yeah, everybody calls him Scotty Nichols. And he has colon cancer, stage 3B. He came for a visit with our good friend Todd, who also worked at Mrs. Fields. We've all been friends 30 years. We had an epic fucking day. It was so epic. We went to Starbucks, we went shopping, and then we went for a hike. I took him up to Shenandoah National Park. We went to Dark Hollow Falls, which is one of my favorite easy hikes because he does have cancer. It's about maybe a mile and three quarters total. The falls are beautiful. And Miss Thing felt so good that day that he climbed the falls. He did not take the path that the park rangers carved out. He decided to make his own path. He climbed up the fucking falls on his own, gave me a heart attack because I'm thinking, oh my God, you have cancer. What the hell are you doing? And after he did it, he got me to do it. I was scared. I didn't want to do it. And so to encourage me, he found an old little old lady who was there with her dog. And he got her to do it and then gave me a look like, see, if this 70-year-old woman can climb the damn falls, I think you can, girl. So I did. Yeah, there's signs everywhere to not do it. But when you got cancer and you're not sure of your outcome, and that's coupled with an HIV status, then radiation is killing all of your T cells in order to treat the cancer. Maybe you climb some falls because you might not be able to tomorrow. So it was an epic day. We had a wonderful time. And literally a week later, he's calling me scared from the emergency room. Please come. I'm here by myself. I think I just had a heart attack. So that happened as well. Rushing up the highway, scared to death, not sure what I would find. Thank God it was just a minor emergency and an example of his new normal. I feel like this cancer took a new step this past week. So he might not be climbing falls in the near future again, but thank God we had that day so that he could do it. There are some new instances and new things happening in his life now as a result of that emergency room visit. He's doing fine. He's home. He's fine. He's still able to work at the front desk. His building has given him a job, so he only has to go downstairs to sit and help folks coming through the door. Thank goodness. Manage your blessings, as he says. Even when you have a setback in your life, manage your blessings. And that has given me pause and encouraged me to keep going with this, to keep creating new memories, to keep going out and interviewing folks and getting their stories, to keep going. And this is why my head feels like it's in a salad spinner, because there's been just so much happening, good and not so good. But we like to focus on the good. We manage our blessings here at Audacious. And as part of that, let's get to today's interview with Clay and Linda Trainum of Autumn Olive Farms. This interview was very close to my heart, not only because they are doing the good stuff, they are raising artisanal, what do you want to call it? Artisanal pigs, like pasture raised ancient heritage breeds of pork. No chemicals, all natural. I saw the woods where they forage. It's good stuff, and they are good people. And their farm lies right across the street from the farm that my grandfather worked for much of his life after marrying into a farm family, the Mays, out in Dooms, Virginia, out on 340, just near the Purple Cow. So I got a little misty-eyed talking to the Trainums, because my family worked that land as well. Good stuff, people. I hope you enjoy it. See you on the flip side.
but it's just like, so maybe that's you know, kind of his basis for something like that.
You're right though, because I have a friend who won't eat it because we were out. Oh, we were at the Apple Festival and they had goat burgers, and he was like, no, and I'm like, why? It's delicious and it's better for you.
Yeah, and it can be terrible. Everything can
be. But like anything. I mean, right. You can have bad
if it's
pork,
right,
bad
it's
goat,
fantastic.
Bad beef.
Yeah,
is this yours?
No,
I know that I was telling Clay, I spoke with a beef cattle farmer. His son actually runs a nonprofit through UVA where he takes rich kids out to farms because they want to pet a cow, and they've never pet a cow. And he donates all the money he gets from selling these tickets to his nonprofit, which gets grass-fed beef to folks that can't afford it. And I was telling Clay that they also raise lambs, and they lost a lot of lambs a couple years ago when it got warm in February, and then got super cold, and the sheep didn't know any better and started giving birth. But he said when they were growing up, they did not eat their beef; they sold it all. So they would because it was just too expensive. You know, they would.
Well, that makes sense.
They would go to Kroger and buy the hamburger because.
The guys at the coastal fishermen that we knew, they would say, well, we never ate, you know, flounder and trout. We ate sea mullet and...
Oh, right. The fancy fish.
Yeah, like, all the fancy stuff got sold and we ate the other stuff.
Right.
And,
are you recording yet?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay.
I am.
I was going to tell you, make sure you put your phone on mute.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fine. This is a very laid-back conversation, as you know. Like I wanted to do it that way because I find out that the conversation just goes better when you don't have like a set of questions to follow, and I'm just thrilled that I got the farm tour first because I was able to see this whole operation, and it's just so beautiful and at how natural it is. And I mean, there are actual like ecosystems here because there was woods and there's pasture and there's like
let me unplug the driveway alarm.
We forgot about something.
We did forget something.
Oh, you guys are so good. It's fine. It's all good.
No, I'm gonna unplug it because it has a weird.
It's like the gothic.
It's funny to put it on the Adams.
He's here.
Like it's the Adams family.
The Grim Reaper is coming up. The
Lurch is going to come walking in.
Exactly.
They thought that was funny. That was.
but as Clay was driving me around on the four wheeler, it's like kind of a gray day, rainy day. There are seasons on a pig farm, I'm sure, as with any farm. Walk me through the season. What is the season of pigs like? Like winter, spring, fall, summer? Like, are there certain things that you guys do at each point in the season that you have to kind of go, okay, now it's May, so we do this. Now it's June, we do this.
Yeah, that's a good question. The seasons certainly have a bearing on what we do and how we do it. The farm has a fair amount of timbered space and shadiness. So we, you know, in the summer months, pigs usually eat less. It's hot, you know, but they have cool environments. So they don't grow as quickly. The meat is a little bit different in the warmer weather. And so it's kind of a slower pace across the board. And we really are managing issues of clean water and temperature related things. So we try to be sure we have them in areas where they're not adversely affected by the heat. So you saw the oak woods and pine woods and even the north pins and kind of those shady areas where we thinned it out. So we thinned out the pines, but we didn't take all the pines out. We just thinned them. So we have a kind of a lightly shaded, much cooler environment.
Okay.
And then in the wintertime, the leaves are off the trees and the winter sun is much lower in the sky to the south. So we orient our houses and structures to capture the warmth from the winter sun.
Oh, so those get moved.
Yeah, like, they get moved, or they may be turned, but the orientation is such that they can capture sunlight and warmth, especially early in the morning, because it may be very cold.
Mm-hmm.
We harvest hay, you know, in the spring and summer months. We stockpile that. We feed that in the winter, and they use it for food and bedding. We basically fill their houses up with good quality hay. That's nutritious for them, and it gives them fiber, which gives them energy, so, you know, and their diet. And so those are very different. Spring and fall, you know, you have, you know, wet considerations early in the spring, and it can be cold, and the ground is still cold. So when we have piglets, we've kind of modified that over the years to balance between optimum weather conditions, because we farrow outdoors.
And farrow, what does that mean for folks that don't know?
That's when a litter of piglets is born.
Okay.
That's the act of farrowing.
Okay.
Birthing. And farrowing would be the same. We want to create an environment that's as favorable as we can in a natural setting.
Yeah.
So we're beginning to farrow some piglets now, and we'll farrow through the summer into the fall. And we have, you know, the shady area, so it's not too hot, and we don't have the cold weather, you know, mortality that goes with winter farrowing. We've done that with houses, with hay, but as you see, we don't have much infrastructure, so we don't have electrical heat lamps and hot water bottles and all of that. We expect the pigs to, the mothers to be able to take care of their piglets properly.
And it's all done naturally.
Like, yes,
staying warm, correct. Staying cool.
Correct.
Staying
right.
hydrated.
Right.
Things like that.
Yeah. So the fall months, the ground is still warm, and you have an abundance of forage and fruits and nuts. So that's a wonderful time. Pork quality is spectacular in the fall in those cool months, and those types of mast finished forages is spectacular. It's good all year, but that's, you know, the best of the best. They're really, they have so much to eat and such an abundance of it. So, and favorable weather conditions. So certainly
That's right. And they're stocking up for winter, basically. Are they eating more in the fall?
They do. The cool weather, you know, cool weather, they eat more.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have that genetic predisposed sense of, oh, the weather's changing, the days are getting shorter, I need to eat and put on fat.
Right,
and,
right. I was really struck by when we were driving around, you said that they actually move their houses if they're not happy with where it is, that they will kind of nudge them and move them.
Yes. We have a large percentage of Ossabaw genetics, and there's a very independent, smart thinking pig.
Yeah.
And they survive 400 years, you know, on a remote island. And if they weren't very smart and intuitive, and they wouldn't survive. So they're very independent. And so we put their houses on top of wooden pallets and filled it with hay because we wanted to get them off the ground to keep them warm, and, you know, especially for young pigs. But they really like to kind of dig and make a bowl-shaped depression. And so these huge A-frame houses we built, they, like, I guess, got together in teams, like workhorses or something. I don't. They collectively moved these 500-pound pallets, like, back
off
of the pallets onto the bare dirt. So
so cool.
Yeah, they have their own list of criteria, and it doesn't always match ours.
Now, I'm curious, because it's been very wet and cold here. Like, we get a couple of warm, sunny days, and then it's almost like it's March again. Is that difficult for you guys? Like, it's almost summer, or it's spring, and no, it's not yet. Like what are the challenges? Because last spring was kind of like this, too. Like, it took a while before summer kind of took hold.
Yeah, that's right. We have some natural structures and things that they take advantage of to kind of compensate for wet, cold conditions or hot conditions. And we maintain a lot of cedar trees that are naturally occurring, and just from observation over the years, we find that cedar trees that stay very dry. They uptake a large amount of moisture out of the ground, and they're very dense, so they shed water from the top and whatever's on the ground. So the Ossabaw genetics in our pigs, they have learned that those are very good areas for them to go when the conditions are wet and cold. So they literally will root up, I think you saw some of that, where they would root up the soil where it could be soaking wet everywhere, and where they are, they're dry as a bone. And so they use that effectively. So we try to, you know, we remove some trees and invasive things that are detrimental, but we try to keep a good number of cedar trees because that's a great cold weather environment, and it's also a great hot weather environment because it's a nice cool shaded underneath, and they really utilize that quite well.
Yeah, and on the tour, because it's you're named Autumn Olive Farms, and you were teaching me about the autumn olive. I did not know that it's actually a very healthy, wonderful plant. Like, it's high in lycopene and like, it's invasive, but it's native and edible and not poisonous, and people should be eating it, and the pigs eat it.
That's exactly right. We built our whole model on how we raise pigs was based on how we raise goats. And our model for raising goats was to take a purpose-bred meat goat and forage it on invasive plants. And that came out of a tremendous drought when we lived in North Carolina. And we were feeding hay in June. And if you do the economics of that, you realize you're like digging a deep hole you're not coming out of.
Yeah. So
and
expensive.
We thought, what in the world? And our animals, their body condition wasn't holding up. And we just observed that we had a utility easement on the property. That was a 200-acre farm. And the roadside right away in this utility easement was like a 100-foot strip. And it was a long distance. And it was lush and fantastic, where everything else was burned up. And we thought, well, we would go out every day and spend time with our animals. We worked in the office and our job at that time at the farm. So we took the animals out, who loved to go out, and we could free-range these animals. And they would just flock onto these invasive plants and forage heavily for an hour. And then they're done, and they just walk right back and go take a nap. And we found that we could do that twice a day. And our animals, again, became very healthy. And we saved a ton of money. And we began to research and catalog the plants they were eating and found some websites, you know, Weeds and USDA Research. And we determined they were eating over 50 different plant varieties, and then a lot of those had research information on them, whether they're, you know, nutritious, whether they were toxic, are they deeply rooted, nitrogen fixing. And we found this spectacular array of positive information about the plants they chose to eat.
Wow.
Yeah, and they wouldn't eat everything. People say, well, goats will eat anything because a goat ate the rag top off of your aunt's, you know, Ford LTD in 75.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're very fastidious. They're very careful, and they eat what is nutritious and
interesting.
And they know it, but they're not sure exactly how that they would pick things at their optimum nutritional time. They would ignore certain plants and then suddenly completely eat them. And we would make notes of those things and observations, but it translated into an extraordinarily healthy meat that was sustainably raised, and it was incredibly delicious and sweet and mild. And that's what we started our business with. And later we incorporated pigs with special genetics that we researched and that we liked, and then we combined genetics, but we put them on the same foraging opportunities that we had used with goats. And we did it in Virginia, which has even more plant diversity and ancient soils and minerality, and all of that translates into terroir.
Yeah.
And, you know, applied to wine, and rightly so, but never really considered for pork, which is has this enormous uptake, very much a product of what it eats.
I just had some prosciutto, and my God, I mean, you can taste the terroir in it, like what these pigs are eating. It's so clean and has such a depth of flavor, and just insanely good, insanely good. Talk about the breeds a little bit, because you've got two separate breeds here, but then you do crossbreeding as well. Where did those two breeds originate, and why did you choose them? Like, why?
Well, probably Linda should tell you, you know, how do we end up, you know, raising pigs?
Yeah, and what was the origins, you know, of all of
it
that.
Was about health, and it was about the way pigs are raised, and she really led us into a better way of living and eating.
Absolutely.
Based on some research that she did, and you really should speak to that.
Well, when we were living in North Carolina, we did not realize our house was infected with mold, severely infected with mold. And it affected our health in that, you know, we going outside and being outside made us feel better, and eating good foods made us feel better. So we ended up moving back here to Clay's original land that his family owned. We came in the fall of 2008, and just, you know, this area is all about food and all about good food, and just started learning more about eating healthy. And, you know, I mean, we always gardened and did things like that, but so I had, I read a book called The Righteous Pork Chop, written by Nicolette Hahn. Very interesting book, and it's about the pork industry and the way the pigs are raised, and, you know, the pollution issues in North Carolina with the pork industry. And I felt very convicted after reading that. And I saw a few videos about pigs. You know, I'm a veterinary technician. That's what I went to school for. But even being that, I mean, you just don't think about it. When you're in the grocery store and you buy pork or you buy beef, I mean, do we really stop and think, I wonder, you know, about that product and where it came from? We're busy, you know. And so anyway, I became more aware, and I thought, I'm not eating pork. I'm not going to eat it because of the way it's raised and because of, you know, the environmental issues with it. So I guess we probably went for 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I would go to a barbecue, and I would eat the bun and everything else, but not the pork. And everybody thought I was a vegetarian, but I wasn't a vegetarian. I just was not going to, ethically, I was not going to eat that meat. So we had our goats at the Frontier Culture Museum doing a forage job there. And they had the breed of Ossabaw pigs, which Clay can tell you the history of that breed. But we learned about them there, and then we ended up purchasing our first breeding sows were from the Frontier Culture Museum.
Oh, cool.
And then, you know, we raised our own pork, so started eating pork again, you know, when we knew where it came from, how it was raised, and and that's how it all started.
Oh, very cool. And, and so did folks come over and maybe you would serve them the pork and got raves about it? Like, what made you go, maybe this could be a thriving business? Maybe
we had been selling our goat meat to some high-end restaurants and to some chefs that, you know, just were crazy about it. And so I believe that we took some samples and said, you know, this is some pork. Would you try it and tell us what you think? And you can.
Yeah, we did. I mean, in regards to our health, I'd found some research that indicated that vitamin D was very, very important to people that had biotoxin illness like us, which is mold affected, but at, you know, sick house center, that kind of a thing. They knew it was very helpful science, but they didn't know exactly why. Hmm. And I did further research, and I discovered that pigs raised outdoors have the second highest dietary source of vitamin D in the world. Nobody knows that.
Really?
Nobody knows.
No kidding.
Cod liver oil is number one.
Yeah.
And it's not very palatable, in my experience.
Mom making you take your
And
teaspoon
like you
or
taste
whatever.
It for until you take your next dose, you know. Yeah. And the number three highest is herring, fish, which is good. It's 4 times lower than pig lard. And I'm a curious person.
Kidding.
No. And I'm a curious
another reason to eat lard, yes.
And
I love it.
If it's you know, kind. We really worked hard. We studied diligently. We were trying to find solutions to regain our health because we were in bad shape.
Yeah.
And so we had to be outdoors a lot. We had to stay away from mold. We had to, you know, moldy clothes, that type of thing. But we had to eat as healthy as we could. That was the one known thing, was that we had to have as clean a diet as we could. Toxin-free, pesticide-free, herbicide-free. Just as healthy as it could be. That's the one thing that we could do. Mm-hmm. And this vitamin D thing was this amazing silver bullet, maybe. And I read Peter Kaminsky's book, parts of it, and he wrote, you know, Pig Perfect. And his world travels determined that the finest bite of pork to be had was this Ossabaw Island. And I thought, well, we've got the finest bite of goat maybe to be had anywhere. And if we're going to raise anything, I want it to be the finest bite that we could possibly raise. If we're going to put in the effort, I mean, let's go for the whole kahuna. Let's go for the real deal.
Yeah.
And we were able to locate some. Nobody explained to us the manageability of the breed and the difficulty, you know, in raising it. But having raised goats, we were actually pretty well suited for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally got some product to eat, and we really felt so good. And I thought, my goodness, you know, there's a direct correlation to our illness and this quality of pork. And, you know, you research it and you realize it's a very healthy product. We've been told a lie.
Yeah.
And if you go back to, you know, early part of the last century, you know, when United States citizens ate the highest per capita volume of pork fat, people used it for everything. It was
did.
It was almost ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, World War I and just prior to that, Procter & Gamble, and what do we do with all this cottonseed waste byproducts, and they were using it in munitions, and this classic thing of, well, we'll just, you know, find some alternate source. They learned to hydrogenate that product. They brought it into the marketplace. They wrote cookbooks. It was a major PR campaign, and it changed the way the country ate. And with that, curiously, that same timeline came hypertension, inflammation, cardiovascular disease. So it was not prevalent in our society when we ate the highest per capita intake of lard.
Yeah.
And so I began to connect some dots, and it matched my observations in life as a boy here. We worked with farmers, and they worked us to death. These guys were, you know, were 90 years old, and their productive capacity, you know, in their 80s and 90s exceeded our modern, the rest of us in our 50s now.
Exactly.
And here they were eating exactly what we're told is terrible for us. Their spread was like fresh eggs, fresh meat, cured meat, you know, all canned vegetables. And
canned pickles. And canned
all of this
biscuits
stuff.
And,
every day.
Yeah, like a big
so it's like
dinner.
So if I read the medical recommendations or the food pyramid, they should all have been dead 20 years ago, and yet they were performing at a very high functional level. And so this new data began to match what I had observed. So we were all in on that. And the healthy thing, starting over here and not being well, we weren't flush with money. We had to make an income. We had to, you know, given our health issues and the limitations with that, we couldn't do a conventional thing.
Yeah.
So we thought, you know, we think this is delicious and we know it's healthy. We know the research is there. Maybe, you know, maybe this would have an appeal to chefs. And so we began to put some product out there, and we discovered that not only was it really healthy, but it was very, very delicious.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. I have eaten it at so many restaurants. Like, anytime I go to a place and it says, you know, pork by Automile, I'm like, okay, I'm ordering it. Because with conventional pork, you know, they call it the other white meat. Like, it's like the vitamin D and all the taste has been bred out of it. I mean, the pigs are, you know, aren't allowed to move. They're fed, you know, grain or whatever, feed or whatever. They can't move sometimes. They wallow in their, you know, one spot for so long. And this is like the total opposite of that. It's got so much flavor. Yeah. It's not white at all. There's like color and taste and marbling. And
We love animals. We met at a veterinary hospital. We've always had animals. I raised Bill Patterson's father's orphan pigs when I was a kid, and this was a part. This was like a rich part of our life. And
yes, I hear your fingernails on the floor.
Oh, he's fine. I talked to Chef Greger one time. And his dog had to chime in and bark a few times at something he said. So it's all good. Gives it ambient sound. But yeah, I love y'all's product. I was telling Clay on the four-wheeler, we eat at Three Penny quite a bit. Jeff Deloff, he buys y'all's pigs, like the whole thing, and posts pictures where he's breaking it down.
And every time I go to Three Penny, I order pork chop.
Right?
Yes, oh, because
how good
he
is
fixes it. Ridiculous, but that's what I order.
Yeah.
Because the way I think only one time I've ordered something different than his pork chop because it's so delicious. It's kind of funny.
You're like, well, I could get this at home, but I'm going to get it here too.
Yeah.
It's just too good.
Yeah, it didn't take us long to figure out that healthy food sells, but delicious really sells.
Yeah.
And,
the proof is in the taste.
So thus was a business born.
Yeah.
And we had absolutely no knowledge of the restaurant industry or chefs or the we were completely ignorant of their needs. So we felt very fortunate. We stepped into a marketplace that there was an opening for really good products. Some people had it and then they couldn't get it, like in D.C. And
mm-hmm.
And so we were able to step into this moment where it was very early for us and the product was very good, really before we knew why it was really good.
Right.
I think we were a bit lucky. And the genetics were there. I mean, it took some time to confirm that you have to have the right genetics. You have to be... You know, you have to match good genetics with a good management program, and that's what very few people even think to do that. And it's a profound difference, and it gives us a huge advantage in the marketplace. But it's also very time consuming. It's very expensive.
Sure.
But it's like, you know, we told a chef one time. He's like, "Do you have pork?" I said, "Well, do you serve bird on the menu?"
Nice.
You know, the difference the difference between a crow and a quail is a profound difference.
Oh, that's nice.
And within the breeds of pigs, there are profound differences in applications and flavor profiles and texture and mouthfeel and fat compositions, fiber, muscle fiber length. All of that is there.
Can you taste a piece of pork and go, that's an ossobaugh, that's a Berkshire, that's a whatever?
Yeah, certainly on prosciutto I can taste. I think it's really, I wouldn't say my palate is terrific. I depend pretty heavily on our customers to tell us, you know, what we're doing. And we very much have designed our pork to tailor it to our customers, our chefs. They're the best in the field. They have the best palates. They understand product utilization. They know what they need to be profitable. We're not a retail. We don't sell retail. Our whole model is to partner and work with the most talented people in the industry to raise a high-end product that's superior, and we depend on them. We ask them questions. We do crosses of breeds. We do forage things in the past, and we put that in front of them and say, how is this compared to, and then we make adjustments over time.
Oh, that's so cool.
So that they're getting what they demanded.
Yeah.
They demanded a particular product that was profitable, that was delicious, that had good growth rates, good yields, characteristics, and that we could put that in our forage program and add in all these invasives and the terroir component, and that's really what makes us very different.
Hmm. And I mentioned this on the tour too, like the relationship between the farm and restaurants. How do both of you stay profitable? Because you have to price your pig where you can make a profit, and then they have to turn around and price the dish that they create from that. Like, how did you figure out where that sweet spot was? Because I'm sure it took some trial and error.
Yeah, we really weren't sure at the beginning. We knew we had a terrific product. We knew we had the attention of chefs who appreciated a terrific product. And yet we didn't have the scale that we needed to get our price points. So we were fortunate, I think, in the beginning year or two, because there really wasn't a product out there like it.
Mm-hmm.
Really, there still isn't, but there's a lot of people that say their products like it. But at that time, there really wasn't, and we could get that. At that time, the price was at a premium, and we were able to do that, and it gave us time to build scale, because efficiency comes with scale. And we knew that, like a restaurant, I mean, if your whole model is set on a 75-seat restaurant and you're putting, doing 25 covers a night, you're not going to do that too long.
Yeah.
And so we made the commitment that we were going to go to D.C. and Richmond and Charlottesville every week, so that they could count on us, that we, even if it was one animal, they would know we would do it every week. And so that's not a profitable thing for quite a while. And we had Bill Patterson, who I grew up raising their orphan pigs, and we'd known our whole lives, and just down the road from us, they'd always raised Berkshire pigs and had gotten out of it and saw what we were doing and really wanted to get back into it, and came to us and said, we'd really want to be able to raise Berkshires again, and we know that, but we don't know anything about what you are doing. Is there something we can do this together?
Nice.
And so we sat down and had those conversations, and we have had a wonderful relationship that goes all the way back to when I was a kid. I mean, I took
one of
their orphan pigs to church on World Hunger Day, and somewhere there's a television footage clip of me feeding a pig at the front of the first Presbyterian Church in Waynesboro, Virginia.
First Presbyterian
in Waynesboro.
My granddaddy was a deacon at First Presbyterian.
He might have been there.
David Henry, I bet he was. Oh my God, the world is getting smaller.
And
he was a deacon there. I kid you not.
Amazing.
I kid you not.
Well, that's it was a very lovely and rather affluent church in Waynesboro. And here I was, the kid out of with the little piglet.
He got dressed up to the nines every Sunday.
So here I was feeding one of Bill's Berkshires.
That's so
And basically making the connection with a congregation is these pigs eat better than a lot of children around the world. And
God, I wish he was still alive. I could ask him about it. He'd probably remember it.
So
that was your contribution. This will help.
So how cool?
That's so
how cool was that to be able to come back later?
Yeah.
And having them work with us, we understood, we were working with chefs, so we understood what the chefs needed. We understood that market side of it, and we're doing that. And they were very good. They knew how to raise. I mean, they're farmers. I mean, they know more about farming than the next 20 farmers put together. I mean, straight legit, full-time. And had raised Berkshire since the 20s. They were driven out of the business by the other white meat in the 80s, the marketing campaign, because Berkshires don't do well in confinement.
Yeah.
They don't have big litters, and it just So that allowed us to have scale. Their ability to ramp up is we're building a base herd. It's one thing to raise a few pigs to sell, but if you're trying to build a herd to supply pigs on a weekly basis at an efficient manner, it takes quite a bit of time and money. And so them coming alongside and us working towards that goal together allowed us to lower our prices 3 years in a row and pass those savings on to restaurants and chefs who, as you know, operate on tight budgets. And we absolutely could identify. We really came to love chefs. They work very hard. We work very hard. They're very passionate about what they do, and we're very passionate about what we do. So we have great respect for that, and we have been able to forge some wonderful relationships. And, you know, they make us look good, and we're working very hard to give them the product
that they do look good.
Yeah, that hopefully that help them to achieve their goals. Mm-hmm. And so with that arrangement and with scale, we were able to get, you know, price points to where it was profitable and that we could, you know, begin to recoup all of our front end, you know, investment, which is considerable. And begin to be profitable.
That's so great. I'm curious because it's an incredibly sustainable model. It's not your typical model of a hog farm or pork farm. Right. Did you have any blowback when you started from other farmers that said, oh, that'll never work?
What do people tell us, like, about that everybody wouldn't, people wouldn't pay us and that we wouldn't, you know, people would stiff us for money and restaurants would do all this and that wouldn't work. And, you know, we...
A little bit of that.
Yeah, we heard from other folks that said, oh, you know, the restaurants won't pay you, they'll rip you, blah, blah, blah. Right. We've always been paid.
Yeah.
We've always been paid. Yeah. We didn't find a lot, you know, we were told the inspectors will crucify you. And we've had a wonderful relationship with our inspectors. I mean, they're there to do a job, and we found them to be reasonable.
Yeah, and your neighbors, too. I mean, it struck me because you have neighbors quite close.
Yes. Yeah.
And I know, you know, driving through some parts of North Carolina and Rhode Island, Delaware, you smell the hog farm from miles away.
What blew my mind was our neighbor said she didn't like it in the wintertime because she had to have her windows shut and she couldn't hear the animals.
Oh,
yes,
the total opposite.
Yes, she loves. Yes,
it's
loves
really
hearing
been,
the animals.
That's
been,
amazing.
It's
yeah.
really been remarkable. We
that's
have wonderful
so
neighbors.
We really do.
This is a long, fairly skinny farm, so we have a lot of neighbors. I mean,
yeah.
15 or 20, I don't know. And, you know, they call us to say, some of your rascal little piglets have gotten through the fence and they're on George Holm Road. You know, they're on the road and they're stopping traffic. We're like, oh my goodness. And we rush up there and then suddenly we meet all these new people and they're so excited about it. And they're like, all these cars are taking video and we're like causing problems. But it has, to a person, has always had this wonderful component.
That's so cute. It creates community.
It has,
you know,
been a real sense of community. And we're aware of the potential problems we could cause. So we're certainly active on our part as to what is sustainable, you know, what's environmentally sustainable here and what's neighborly sustainable here. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have times where we have some odor and those issues and things, and you know, and weather and, you know, things can affect that. And so we haven't been perfect, but we're the pursuit is to be absolutely a wonderful neighbor. And they look out for us. I mean, they call us. We have neighbors call us, like, I've got a coyote in my back. You know, do you think you could shoot him from your side? I said, no, I can't because your house is there. He said, well, can you come over to my house and shoot back the other way? I said, actually, yes, I can, because we're behind the hill.
Right.
But he knew that we had suffered predator losses, and he was really giving a heads up. And turned out that particular coyote had really bad mange and distemper, which is highly contagious, and he has these beautiful dogs and he walks them there every day. Oh, so,
yeah.
So it protected, you know, mm-hmm. both of our interests. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we consider ourselves very fortunate in a lot of ways.
That was interesting to me because you said you had some huge predator losses last spring, and it was because the fox and coyote had mange. That was new. I had not heard of that.
We think that's the correlation. Because
I wonder if that's an environmental thing. If that's like a climate change like thing.
It's we don't have the answer. We know that it's not just in this area. We know that there's some of that in North Carolina and the wolves, the red wolves down there. And we've seen foxes, 20 miles from here with the same condition. And talking with the county and animal control that there's an issue, and there's some across the mountain as well. So we don't know what the genesis of that is, but we had never had a problem with predators. Foxes could come and go freely because they have a role. You know, they eat rodents, and they're very beneficial, and they're enjoyable to watch, and they have a place. However, last year in the spring, you know, we farrow outdoors, and it's a very beautiful thing. When it's right, it's a very beautiful thing. You see mothers with the ability to exercise their instincts as mothers, how to maneuver and protect, and how to select where they're going to farrow and build their own nest. And in cold weather, it'll be oriented in a sunny location. And for winter sun, in hot weather, it'll be in a cool location. You get to see all that play out. But last spring, and with that happening, we suddenly began to have significant losses of newborn piglets. And it wasn't until we installed multiple trail cameras and around the farm that we could see the foxes actually sneaking in and snatching piglets right off of a mother.
Wow.
Who had just farrowed and is in a weakened condition, and the piglets are not that mobile yet, mm-hmm. and just snatching them one after another. And mm-hmm. so we had to, we chose to try to protect our
sure.
interest, and in the thinking that maybe we had a rogue group, and that if we culled them, then maybe we would get back to normal.
Right.
Know? So
that's a very real part of having a farm like this that's so
right.
based in nature and yeah. Nature's of cycles and things
yeah.
like that.
I mean,
has your veterinary background given you an edge with the pigs? Like, can you look at one and go, yeah, she's not feeling too good, or,
mm-hmm.
or that one's kind of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't call the veterinarian every time you have an animal that doesn't feel good.
Right.
You know, pigs...
Very expensive.
Pigs are... they're like the goats. That was very time consuming. Goats seems like they do everything they can to get sick. they were more of a challenge. Pigs not so much. I mean, you do occasionally will have, especially with the weather change, you can have a pneumonia come, and so yes, so the background has been very helpful, because then we don't have to call the veterinarian every time, and I can also call and the veterinarian can advise us on what to do, and then
he
can do it too, so
yeah.
Yeah, we take care of a lot of our own things.
Well, and pigs have a lot of human qualities. They have personalities. I was telling Clay, I'm reading this book called Pigtails, and Burdencourt, I can't think of his name, but he writes about a pig that actually lives in this village, and he visits every house, and his name is Christopher, and he's smart. Like, he can recognize voices, and like, mm-hmm. can you talk about that a little bit? Like, are there certain of your pet, because I know you keep pets, you have certain pets, and then you have the breeding pigs.
Yeah, we do. We have, we probably have more pets than we should, but, it just kind of happens that way. But, what we do is hard. When you raise animals and you send them off, that's a difficult part of what we do, because we both love animals. But we understand it, and that, in order to have good food, that's part of it. So we have pets that we, spend time with, and so that kind of helps with that situation. And
Sparkles was very cute.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. It's, you know, there's some that their personality just comes out when, you know, some do and some aren't. And as Clay said, you know, the Ossabaw's a little bit easier because they're more standoffish. So,
yeah, know. if we're sending animals for mate, I'd prefer an animal that, like, doesn't care for me or, like, bites right. my leg or something versus
they definitely have a look. They were kind of looking at me like,
exactly.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah, standoffish, but
delicious.
yeah.
Yeah.
My yeah. husband, every time we go to the county fair, and they have the little petting zoo, he just looks at the pigs and goes, ribs. And all the kids are like, what are you doing?
We, you know, and the Ossabaw is doesn't make a very good pet. We have a couple we've raised in the house from, some tragic situation, a bad mother or something, and they got very sick, and we brought them in. They end up being pets, and... But we have people who come and to visit the farm and farm, you know, restaurant staff and children. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, we take that very seriously because that's like this opportunity to speak to a child and to build a positive memory and a proper memory of a working farm. So to have those pets here, I mean, they really have a role. Because as you see, we're in large spaces and wide open spaces in the woods, and those animals are generally, you know, more standoffish with the Ossabaw genetics. So to have animals that are more personable and engaging and hands-on really is very important.
Sure.
And so, you know, we justify the expense of them, and they have a tenured position, and they all have official titles. And, you know, Sparkles is the tour director and... the North Pen, the Pinewoods Pen, and then, you know, we have them. But they really, and they bring us joy.
Yeah.
You know, they really bring us happiness. I mean, we love animals, and we're increasingly disturbed. You know, we didn't eat pork for 2 years, and Linda really led in a source of consciousness about it. It's one thing to be ignorant of it and not know.
Absolutely.
But once you know, to continue to go down that path, it's very abusive. I mean, how pigs are, they're very intelligent animals.
Right.
And so do we not have a huge responsibility? If we're going to choose to consume an animal, we have an enormous responsibility as to how that's done. So, you know, we see products coming in the marketplace now, and you'll see them in Charlottesville and other places, and they say they're from a local farm, and, you know, it's a small family farm, when in fact those are indoor commodity-raised animals, and they're using our buzzwords, and they're trying to mirror that they're us kind of a thing.
Because it's a trend.
And it's and for us, it's a huge ethical issue, because it's not a healthy product.
Right.
It can't be. And how, I mean, it's abusive. And I think history is going to judge us harshly as our generation, our grandchildren, our children and grandchildren are going to look back and say, what was wrong with you all that you so willingly partook of that product raised that way? And it won't be defensible. It's not a defensible position.
Not at all.
You don't have to spend much time with pigs to realize there's a serious responsibility. So, you know, it's a disturbing thing.
That book taught me so much because I didn't know about that. And it does make you want to eat more responsibly.
Yeah.
How can a consumer make sure that... Barring, you know, coming out here and meeting you and you know, eating at those restaurants, how can a consumer avoid the fakers? Like, how do you know what you're buying is the right sustainable meat?
I think one thing is that if, because social media is so popular now, if you look on somebody's social media and they don't have pictures of animals on their farm and then with the animals on their farm, And I mean, you can pretty much tell. You can look at somebody's Instagram and say, but wait, they only show dishes and product. They don't have any pictures of their pigs.
Yeah.
And the pictures they do have of their pigs, those look like they were like taken by in a studio by a professional photographer.
Yeah.
You know, you can look at us. We're out here on the farm with the pigs, you know, and we, you know, yes, we show dishes and things too, but we also have the balance of that you can see that. So that's a good way, you know, to be able to tell and, all, you know, also to ask questions. And
Food Waste is doing an enormous job and a very challenging job, because they're aware that there's a great deal of, or there's a lack of integrity, both in purveyors and restaurants. I mean, we've had restaurants that have put us on their menu, on their boards, on their... Mm-hmm.
They haven't used
our products, and they haven't used us in years.
But they did sometime 4 or 5 years ago.
They may have done it once or twice, and it's strictly... And they
Good Lord.
And worse than...
Really?
Yeah. Worse than that.
Do you say something? Do you say, you know how
Yeah, we're so busy, but yeah, we're beginning to address that in a more formal way.
You know what? Tell me and I'll say something. Like, if you don't want to involve yourself, I will. I'm a mouth.
We work very hard.
When was the last time you purchased from them, actually?
Yeah. We work very hard to build a brand.
Yeah.
And that somebody that comes in a restaurant and is going to pay more money because that product is our product in the hands of a very talented chef. And it's not. And they've paid that. That's fraud.
It completely is.
That's like... commerce.
And meanwhile, the Cisco truck's in the back.
Yeah. And so that does happen. And sometimes we can track it down. Sometimes we can't. Maybe more disturbingly is the people that that have health issues. Their children have health issues. And they don't have a lot of discretionary income. And they're sacrificially spending money at a farmer's market to get what they believe and what is advertised as a really healthy product. You know, kind of like what we did. We couldn't afford it. We had to raise it.
Yeah.
We had a heck of a lot of fun doing it. And only to have that product that so-called purveyor has basically said, oh, here's a market to exploit, and they're taking a product from somewhere else that could, you know, repackaging it and selling it to that consumer.
Yeah.
That's an outrageous thing.
That's crazy.
And, you know, the disturbing thing is that people, you know, we have, you know, one thing is very clear to us, and that is our customers are almost exclusively people who really, really care about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if Jeff Deloff is a great example.
Yeah. So passionate. It came through clear when I spoke with him.
You ask him how many hours he works, he won't even tell you.
Right.
He's, you know, he's breaking down a half a pig at night or after
and he has
hours.
He has pictures to prove it on the restaurant.
He's
again,
doing all of that.
His Instagram pictures.
Mm-hmm. And he's bringing you that product into a restaurant. It's delicious. It's at a fair price point. And a lot of what he's doing is sacrificial. And very few people will do it.
Yeah.
JM Stock is another one. Oh. They're not
great guys.
They're not like, you know, Whole Foods. They'll get, you know, a couple of somebody's lamb and then 98% of it's commodity. And it's like a window dressing. Those guys are rare in the industry. And Food Waste, you know, going around the state and the country, he said there's just almost nobody doing what, you know, what Three Penny's doing and Commune in Virginia Beach and JM Stock and stuff that are wholly committed to an ethical product that's never going to be inexpensive. You see, it's not efficient.
Right.
It's about quality and it's about integrity of that animal. I mean, it's just, I don't see, you know, maybe it's a strong analogy, but, you know, we've certainly had chefs and restaurants say, well, you know, we have to buy this commodity stuff because, you know, the price points don't work and all that stuff. I said, you know, that's what the farmers said about slavery.
Right.
The justification, I understand But my comeback is, well, you've built an economic model that you're now a prisoner to, but you're still in control, and that animal treated the way they're treated in a highly intelligent animal, you can't just sweep that out of, you know.
Right. It's that unwillingness to see another way or another method. Like, oh, it's just too hard, so I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing because it's always how we've done it.
Right.
Rather than looking at it from another side of the table. Like, right. Well, this is my goal. How do I get to that goal?
Exactly.
And with being conscious of every step.
Challenge yourself.
Yeah.
Challenge. If you're at the top of your game, challenge yourself. Is this the way? I mean, in the farming models, when we began to look into this, you know, our county extension agent said, well, if you can... You know, they laughed about our silvopasturing model of raising goats and invasive, and, you know, autumn olive and walnut trees. They just thought that was that was hilarious. Well,
guess what?
Yeah. You know, super fruit. Walnuts is the healthiest nut in the world. Every year, still, it's delicious American black walnut, healthiest nut in the world. If you have pigs eating that and you have autumn olive, guess what? A walnut tree in conjunction with an autumn olive, the walnut tree captures the nitrogen and grows 50% faster.
No kidding.
You have a timber program that generates revenue. You have nuts, the healthiest nuts in the world that your pigs can forage if they're a large size pig, full size.
Yeah.
You have this autumn olive plant that's a super fruit without the major story yet. The lycopene, the phytonutrients, the protein in the leaves, it's alfalfa to goats and pigs. And they're laughing about it and telling us, well, if you could raise some cows and if you can pay your taxes every year, you're a successful farmer. And I'm like, I don't accept that.
Good for you. That's amazing.
I mean, I've been in Africa and I've been in Indonesia and I've seen where if you had 100 acres of fertile land, you should be wealthy. Mm-hmm. If you really understood and you could make that, if you couldn't make, they would think you're foolish. How could you be sitting on fertile land and be the impoverished farmer?
Mm-hmm. It's about working with the land that you have rather than taking this ancient model and plopping it onto the land you have and making that fit. Was it a square peg in a round hole?
Yeah, and nobody asked the question. Nobody questions it. And it's
it's all we've always done that. It's like, put some cattle out.
And it's amazing because, you know, you see some of the things that we do. We'd like to be able to plant more forages. We have a lot of trees, and so we're trying to get that thin enough so that we can go underneath and plant nutritious forages. You build soil, you build tilth, you hold water and sediment and add nutrients, and it's fabulous for your pork, so you get a better quality.
Yeah.
And you have lower cost inputs with that. Win, 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 win. And what does the traditional model show? It's like you plant, you know, you cultivate the soil. So your carbon footprint, you mean, just look at that. Mm-hmm. You cultivate all this ground, whether you no-till or not. You glyphosate everything. You no-till in your products. Then you harvest all the product with equipment and you pay for all that. Then you store all that. You haul it maybe off-site or you have storage. Then you pull it all back out and grind it and create a finished product that you feed to your animals with heavy equipment and cost and diesel fuel. Then you go scoop up all the manure they create, and with equipment you haul that out all over your fields to fertilize it. And repeat the process.
And the equipment you probably have a huge loan on that you're paying off.
Compare that to plant forages. You may have to add lime and balance your, you know. So your animals are adding nutrients to the ground. You plant your forages. Then you let your animals go in and eat the forages. And you can plant now. I mean, you got models now that you can plant. You know, you can have forage year-round. You have to supplement some in the winter, so you'd have to make some hay. It's not, you know, 100% in our Area 6. But you get three seasons worth of food with some supplemental inputs. Mm. And you're not hauling anything anywhere. I mean, you're hauling healthy animals off the farm for slaughter, and you're seeding it and maybe dragging the ground.
And you're done.
And you're saving a fortune.
Yeah.
Your carbon footprint is a fraction, and they laugh at us.
That's so crazy.
Who's laughing? You know, it's absurd.
I know.
Absurd.
It's so crazy.
So, yeah, we just didn't accept those kinds of models. We just looked at a global model and said, if you have fertile ground, whatever, this was an overgrown farm,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't do any of those original models. But you can do these other things and make ground that's not considered profitable, profitable, and you can enhance the quality of the land and the nutrient levels. I mean, we're still deficient in nitrogen. We have animals all over, and we don't do a whole lot of rotational stuff. And we test everything every year, and we're still deficient in nitrogen. In nitrogen. So, yeah, that's building a better model.
And it's so admirable to me, and probably to me a big reason why you're successful, because when you started the farm, it was overgrown. And so you guys kind of looked at it and said, well, let's get the goats to eat it, you know, and clear it out that way.
Right.
Work with it.
Work in harmony with what it gives you.
Yeah.
And the internet has been available for, what, 30 years now?
Yeah.
And we all know how to read.
Right.
I mean, it's the Library of Congress is available to all, I mean, on our phones.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have any curiosity, any intellectual curiosity at all, there are answers to these things. We just have to have the curiosity and the diligence and refuse to accept.
Yeah, the status quo or whatever, what's been done for so many decades and hundreds of years.
Yeah, these people have made a mess.
Like Autumn Olive, I know you're in restaurants and you're over at JM Stock. Where else can people find this wonderful product?
Gosh, we're in a lot of restaurants. But as far as individuals, JM Stock in Charlottesville, Stock Provision in Belmont Butchery in Richmond.
Oh, I love Belmont Butchery.
Glenn's She's Garden amazing. Market is a terrific partner of ours in D.C.
Oh, yeah.
Danielle.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Okay.
They came out and did a farm tour, and their commitment to all things excellent is, they are remarkable people, and that is a growing business with a real sense of conscience and integrity. So we're very careful about, you know, who we choose to work with, and we've been fortunate. I mean, we beat the bushes, we went to all the places, and we, you know, took samples, and we haven't sold in 2 years, and we don't do our growth has really simply been word of mouth and referral, and chefs move around, and they take us with them, and usually we stay where we're at. So our growth has been very careful, and it, you know, like we talked about, to have scale so that we can make a fair living and expand. You ought to be able to, you know. We also don't accept the model of, you know, the farmer. The classic farmer model is, woe is me, I'm the victim, everybody's against me, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, if you have access to land, you are privileged.
Mm-hmm.
If we're that fortunate, and what we do with that, if we can't create a business model, I mean, if we can't, it's business.
Mm-hmm.
Stop crying. It sets a bad example. Woe is me. Go.
Yeah.
If you can't make it work, do it another way.
Rather than looking at what you lack, look at what you have.
Yeah, they're all against me. This is all bad. This is blah, blah. It's like,
so great.
If your ground won't produce what you originally intended, there's a need for all kinds of products. There's all, acreage limitations, specialty products.
Yeah.
There's a need for integrity and very fine products. And anybody should be able to write a business plan to say, we need to achieve a certain margin. For us, interns may work for some people in some situations, but we're not seasonal. We don't have an off season. We're busy every week. and we're in business every week. We want full-time people. We want people like Miles and our two sons and Myra with integrity and a commitment. We want to be, you know, the best place they've ever worked. So we want to be able to pay them. So we want our business model and our growth to allow us to be able to pay quality people a quality life, you know, so that they can have a good life.
Not compromising on the product or on what you pay your employees. That's amazing. It's so great.
We had to, you know, we kind of had to trick our sons into coming to work for us from the beginning.
Are they going to take the business over? That you pass it down to
that's,
them?
I mean, that's the offer was, in the beginning, we were not making money. We, you know, we were doing one or two pigs a week, no matter, so that they knew that we're coming every week. And they both had, you know, were in decent, good situations. And we said, look, you know, we think this has a real future and we need help. And we want to be able to grow this and leave you all something that's real. But it's pretty lean on the front end. But if you can come and you can help us and get us there, then that is our commitment.
That's so great.
And so they've been so good. We could never have done what we've done without them. And we do our deliveries, we do sales, and I'm out here selling on my phone. I mean, I've got texts coming in, you know, while we're here, and. And then they'll be heading to Maryland tonight, they overnight. They'll be on the floor. They do our processing under inspection in the morning. That 20-foot reefer truck will be loaded with product, and they'll deliver all day, Southern Maryland, D.C., Northern Virginia, working their way all the way back tomorrow night. We restock the truck, all of us. It might be 11 o'clock.
Right.
And then Tyler will get up, you know, on Friday morning, and he'll do all the big deliveries if it's in, you know, the Wintergreen area or Nellie's Ford or Charlottesville, Richmond, and Virginia Beach. And Tyler and Miles will both do all the short and small deliveries because, you know, we're very
Logan
busy.
Logan and Miles.
Logan and Miles. Mm-hmm.
Processing, is that done here? Do you send that offside?
We have a couple processors. We have our primaries are in Maryland.
Okay.
And they do very good work.
Yeah.
We never had success at good quality processing. We sell at some fantastic locations, and we can have the best product ever, and they can ruin it in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And we went through that with a couple local processors, and it cost us a lot of money when we didn't have any extra money, and they couldn't have cared less. And we thought, well,
again, that commitment to quality.
Yeah, if that's the way it is, we'll go mow grass and do a landscape. I mean, I'm not gonna do this and then have that stuff. So we found that further north we went, it got very professional, and we learned what it was because we were ignorant. We didn't know, but boy, once we found out. So we drive there every week, and we don't complain about it because we get great quality, and we get to work with great, you know, chefs as a result.
That's true.
They know the difference. They know good and not good, and so.
Well, and I'm curious, if two of you have been together a while. How did you all meet? I always like those types of stories.
Oh, it's a good one.
I was a veterinarian technician at a animal hospital close by here, and
you brought in an orphan pig.
No, he brought in a dog.
A wounded Labrador retriever.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
A real dog.
And that was all she wrote. Right?
I was
oh
the first.
Oh my God,
I was
like a Harlequin romance.
I was the first
dog is sick.
Advocate for home health care for pets. But her vet wouldn't allow it.
No. Is it? Then that's how you guys met.
Mm-hmm.
That is adorable. Mm-hmm.
34
on that.
Yeah.
34
Actually, 35
years.
Years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How have you? You're not. You guys got to be my age. When did you meet him?
Oh, I married her when she was 15.
That's not true.
I was actually
Jerry Lee.
Well, I was actually 19.
When we 19? Got married.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
I was 22.
Young. Both of you were young.
We were mm-hmm. in love. I mean, we just.
You knew.
We thought that
all
we
that,
knew.
All that is precious. Oh my God, yeah. That's amazing. That's wonderful.
Yes. Yep. So we've always had animals, and we've always enjoyed that. I mean, all the way back to doing that goat thing in the drought. That was like we were both working, you know, doing international work and office based out of there. And just getting out and having time together was like, you know, we loved that.
Yeah.
And we get to do that, which is real special.
That's so cool. Yeah. And involve the whole family.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful out here. I've had such an amazing day and wonderful time talking with both of you.
Well, thank you so much for coming. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Did we cover everything? I do like to end up with a couple of fun speed round questions.
Dangerous.
I know. They can be. If you have $5 and you're on a road trip and you stop at a convenience store, what are you going to buy?
I'm going to buy almonds.
Almonds?
Nuts, yeah.
Roasted, salted, unsalted?
Yeah, just something healthy. I do like M&M's too.
Oh, that's
too.
True. I'm talking to the folks with the so I'm at, and I asked the junk food question. Oh my goodness.
No, it's all right. And I do like M&M's though.
Do you have a secret junk food vice that you don't share with folks? That you hide
he definitely has one.
I like chocolate.
Chocolate.
Yeah. Good, he's a chocoholic.
I like good chocolate.
Oh, I should have brought you some. I just talked with Gerhard.
Oh yeah, that would have been nice.
Man.
That's delicious.
Tell you what.
Oh, his malt caramels, man.
Great treat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good chocolate. It's a real special treat.
And again, such commitment to, like, the craft and the quality every step of the way.
They're
like
a great example.
Yeah, no kidding. What's your favorite Gerhard's?
I like the caramel stuff and the darks and anything with raspberry and chocolate and...
The truffles.
Caramel with sea salt and truffles. I guess it's a big list.
Anything.
Yeah. I like the variety of Gerhard's.
Yeah. Just anything. It's all good.
I haven't had a bad one.
It's all good.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a bucket list city that where you want to go eat? Like if somebody gave you a free plane ticket today?
Yeah, definitely. Italy. To Italy.
We'd like to eat our way around Italy.
Yes.
As I look at the leg of prosciutto.
Yes. And the wild mushrooms, the foraging for mushrooms. My stepfather was a mycologist and a chemist. And so he taught us we never knew about all these wonderful mushrooms. And so that's been a real treat that, you know, we were able to harvest wild mushrooms over the years. And here is a good place. But doing that in Italy and eating that food and that culture and would be very special.
Again, like taking time with food and sitting around a table and just having a friendly talk. And I even dispensed with the microphones today because the energy was so good around the kitchen island. Very Italian.
Prosciutto will do that.
With prosciutto, yes. I'm like, let's just use this. It'll be fine. Who in the I always ask this last to kind of pay it forward. Who in the food community should I talk to next that you admire and or is really doing it right these days?
I'll tell you, Matt Green at Stock. If you haven't, and Alex Import and all those guys over there, their commitment to do what they do and to make that work is they really set a model. I mean, there's no bullshit there. I mean, it is straight, top quality ingredients.
No joke.
Great skill and craftsmanship, and they're producing something that's... I imagine you could go to, you know, larger cities, and you're never going to get something like that. You're going to have to go somewhere special.
Right.
So he would certainly be on my list.
That's funny. He's on my short list, because I kind of do like I've got so many, and I've narrowed it down to five, and he's... I'm emailing him.
Because they're taking a risk. I mean, they're taking a risk to do that.
Yeah.
Because guess what? You know, the only customers they're going to have are the people who really care.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the percentage of the buying public who really, really cares enough to, you know, go out of their way, pay a little more, you know, be inconvenienced or whatever? I'm not convinced that's a very large number.
No. No, so. I'm not either. And I'm so glad the two of you are doing it and doing it right every single day. And I have to end with this because I'm kind of having a moment here because my grandmother's farm is within spitting distance of Autumn Olive. And to hear that this is your family farm and that you're passing it down to your sons, just it feels like I was supposed to come here and talk with you today. Like, this is really neat. It's just like history happening.
Well, the clouds have cleared, so we're going to have to, we're going to ride up on this bluff. And you're going to be able to look right across the river and see.
See what your grandfather said.
Yes.
I farmed all of this, right?
He would stretch his arm out and say, as far as you can see, I worked it all.
This is good ground.
This is good ground. And we go, that's great, Granddaddy. Can we go eat now?
I worked on the farm right beside that farm. And I helped him bale hay, who's an older man, Mr. Forbes. And I've had lunch there many times, and that's like the next really pretty farm. And but he farmed a lot of land over here, and so when I was young, you know, in the summertime, we baled hay. That's how we made money, and we loved it. You know, you could go work at McDonald's or something like that.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But you know, when you're young and like you don't start baling hay till like 11 o'clock, so you know it was kind of a nice summer job. But that's we always had that common experience of. You know, being connected in that way. And,
yeah.
And that's nice.
God, and what a great connection here today. Thank you both so much.
Well, thank you.
We really appreciate you having an interest in what we do. And,
absolutely.
And being able to share that. It means a lot.
Absolutely. And so many people recommended you folks to talk to as that last question.
That's kind
and
of...
so, you know, when you hear it 3, 4, 5... I think Jeff even had said something, and I was like, "Well, it might be time to talk."
Yeah,
and then we reached out to one another, and I posted pictures of the Kreiser farm or the Harner farm.
Yes.
And you were like, "We're just right next door," and I'm like, "Okay, I believe in signs. This is a sign. We're gonna do this."
Yeah,
all right. Thanks again, guys.
Thank
You're
you.
Certainly welcome. Yeah. Thank you.
What did I tell you, right? Good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you, Linda and Clay, for speaking with me, for being such wonderful hosts, for taking me on a tour of your beautiful, beautiful farm. I'm proud to know them. They are really fighting the good fight. They have a mission that they stick to so audaciously. They don't cut corners. And the product, if you've ever had a pork chop at Three Penny Cafe, or gone to JM Stock and purchased their product, you know how good it is. Thank you, Tim. Or no, thank you, Linda and Clay. And next up, we have Tim and Sarah Gorman from Cardinal Point Winery. I'm sitting here looking at my notes because, as I said, my mind's in a salad spinner. So next up in 2 weeks, you will hear from Tim and Sarah Gorman from Cardinal Point Winery. I'm going to close out here with some ambient audio from Autumn Olive Farms. These are the British pigs who had a lot to say. A lot to say. Thanks for being my guest here today. Want to thank my sponsors at Teej.fm, T-E-E-J.fm, and at Patreon.com/AudaciousPod. You can find me at iTunes. The website's Audacious.co. Send me your comments. Submit a review. And until next time, I am Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. Maybe not so loquacious today because I'm froggy, but I'm very gracious, managing my blessings. And when it comes to learning about food and keeping those connections going, I'm audacious, and I hope you are as well. Big love, guys. Big love, big love. See you at Love Fest. Cheers.
Really
going to
be really good sauce. Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
They've got a pretty big area as well, so that's...
The ambient sounds of pork. Yes, good afternoon. How are you?
I love this weather, obviously.
I've got nothing for you except a microphone.
Now, this is magical weather for them.
Oh, I bet they do. They probably prefer this to like a hot summer day, right? Nice and cool. Look at your long eyelashes.
Yeah, look at your long eyelashes. Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
so weak. Oh, so cute. Uh-oh, big love.
It's like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm supposed
I'll
to
give it a
this.
Shot, right? Too funny. Now, what are they rooting over here on this board?
What?
They were all, like, congregating here on this board.
I just flipped it over, and it's, like, something new and exciting.
Yeah.
If they had a piece of plastic, they'd be
right, they got to check it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Something new to discover.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're going to flip it back over.
Feeds their curiosity.
Yeah.
And boredom. I mean, we like feed a lot of hay in the winter. We use hay for bedding, good hay. And for a lot of reasons, but part of it is they just really enjoy.